What are the most interesting questions or problems that arise for us regarding the theory of evolution? Yes, Don.
Well, since man has become aware of evolution that it occurs, and scientifically and in other ways tries to control it, the hideous social Darwinism of early in the 20th century and the Nazism there, people now saying that, the scientists saying, well, give us your order, we can make your baby any way you want, with curly hair or whatever it is that you want. But of course, we can't control nature. It would go too far beyond us. It's an infinite thing. And that is also evolving. And so my answer to the question is, what kind of a slop are we about to make with evolution in screwing up mankind, or at least an attempt at glorifying mankind, but actually making a slop of it? That's my fear. And that's
what's that word?
Slop. S-L-O-P.
What kind of slop will we make of it?
Evolution. Being aware of it, being, you know, we can... There's people in America, Barb or somebody or other, who said we can control our own evolution and stuff up there. I think this is very scary. Because all of that's important.
We should go around.
Okay.
Systematically, but if whoever would like to contribute something can do so right away.
My question regarding evolution has always been, how did the transition happen from apes to man? I've always wondered, how did that actually happen?
Only from ape to man, or
from... Or did it happen? No, yes, I suppose between, among all species, I mean, from shrews to elephants, but how did we get there? It's always been a question. How did... It's true they changed slowly, but what happened one fine day when, you know, I think when it was still in the animal kingdom, it was not so difficult to understand that there was adaptation, and then maybe isolation on a different continent, and then something else happened to a species. But when there was a drastic level, mind comes onto the scene. How exactly?
So you think that the process of variation and adaptation in lower species is more understandable than the phenomenon of the emergence of the human being from its whatever line of relatedness it has, the primate line? Anyone else?
Well, the ancient Egyptians, great kings, and that prior to the pharaohs, are just very, very sophisticated.
What role did the
great kings of Egypt, that period, play in the evolution, because there seems to be a schism or a difference between their culture and in that period of time what we call humans on this planet. So I just, I'm wondering what influence, or...
Well, all of the ancient cultures are a mystery, and each one of them is like a species, almost a subspecies of human beings with respect to culture. And so what exactly is the difference between one culture's contribution to the evolution of culture, which is what you're asking about, I think, and another civilization's contribution to the evolution of culture? You think that there is a difference, and you're asking what it is?
Well, I'm wondering if there's such a thing as digression that occurred.
Do you have the impression that that civilization was more advanced?
In some ways, prior to the pharaohs, and the way it was about, there was certain...
Of course, one could ask where you get that idea from. I mean, I think it would be a very debatable question of whether there was any civilization that was more particularly outstandingly more advanced than another one, especially if there's no historical record of it. So there's a historical record of the Egyptian civilization, you know, for example, Akhenaten, which occurred at the time of the exodus of the Jews, and there were many outstanding religious phenomena that happened at that time. Are you thinking about prior to that?
Yeah.
Like, how far back are you thinking?
10,000.
Prehistory. So if it's prehistory, that by definition means that we don't have anything to go on.
Well, Gilgamesh,
I'm adapting. So, the architecture, because maybe in India it's a question of scripture, and it's a question of buildings.
Okay, now I would like to just take this opportunity to point out the difference between the great gulf of difference between the three questions that have just been asked. One of them goes back maybe 50 to 100 million years. One goes back maybe 10 to 20,000 years. And one is about now. All three of them seem to be holding some concept of the human being as different from nature, as extraordinary. And so how does this leap happen from the animal to the human? How does this leap happen from one civilization to the next? Perhaps in a regressive direction, and perhaps not in a regressive direction, but anyway, that's open. And then, how can we who pretend to want to control nature presume to be able to control nature? Do so or not in a way that is beneficial? And are we outside of nature in this process? Don seemed to imply that nature evolves, but then human beings are doing something to it.
Interfering is what I meant.
Interfering, right. Okay, so those are three somewhat related questions, but at focusing on very, very different temporal perspectives.
Well, you sort of brought up a big problem, though, that humans see themselves as separate from nature, somehow. So this process, we can study it in books, we can talk about it, but there's a sense that we're not part of it. So that, I would say, is an interesting problem in our perception. How are we, I mean, why do we think we're not part of nature?
Are we part of nature?
Are we part of nature?
And why do we seem to think that we are not?
I have a question.
Good. What is it?
The question is, these seemingly not fitting questions seem to fit very well. They're pointing us towards this unnatural phenomenon in the nature, the evolution of consciousness. And that is the major question. What is really evolving?
Right. What is it that's evolving?
But then you seem to be stating exactly the same question, because you're implying that the evolving of consciousness is different from the evolving of nature.
Exactly.
Maybe I can add there my question. And since I'm small, why is this different that all the philosophies are from male men and they are the same thing? If you look in research with them, then male men and the females are not so there. Maybe there is a correlation to this also.
It's because the mailmen go to the house while the husbands are not present, and they propagate a species of why are males philosophizing more than females?
No, it's because it's a mind order. That's a consciousness and mind was brought forward from male incarnations in the whole evolution.
Now, what she
is that what you think?
Huh?
Is that what you think?
No, you can everywhere. It's, I mean,
what she is connecting is female with Prakriti and nature.
Yeah.
And male aspect of this evolution of consciousness as separate from Prakriti, which happened to be also a part of the whole mindset or the whole paradigm which we see as domination of male. It's an interesting question.
May I ask you then, just to get a little more clarity, are you proposing that our problem of thinking ourselves outside of nature is coming from the problem of male dominance of nature?
No, that's too short. For me, it's just when I look, who do philosophy? Who do the main thinking? It's always a male. And now also even in the Indian tradition, now also Miramiya spoke about that. Now this savitri is a female main person bringing it forward. So there's something new in it. And this, I see it. Because I worked in the room for 25 years and looked for a female philosopher. You have the philosophy of daily life also, but not the higher mind. And it is one important step in human evolution that the mind develops high. So that is my question to put to the evolutionary process. What is the meaning of it? What is the process? And what would be the next step to it?
What is the meaning of the evolutionary process, and what will be the next step of it?
Not in a male-dominating environment.
will the evolutionary process change? And then I would also like to clarify this still a little bit more, because it seems that probably you're associating this whole question with the idea of human evolution and not evolution in general. You're saying that the process of human evolution may change and that the male will not be so dominant.
There's one mind, because you go to pure mind, ideal mind, and work in the ideal mind. And this is, several people have more this developed, and I don't say it's male, but mainly are male. the other one is that we are more, when you have to take care of children and all these families, you work on this more. This is the approach more.
Is it really the result of male domination that we are speaking of, our presence in nature is different, or it is something else? It can be a very interesting question.
Well, and then, and then there's, but when she mentions higher mind,
it's just to point out.
Question about this.
Let's keep going around and see if we get some more.
I mean, this is referring to, but I'm actually asking her.
Yeah, I know.
Clarify.
Did you capture her question?
Not really. Can you say your summary of her question?
Yes, it was very good to you did already. Yes. Is it related to the man-dominated paradigm that we speak about our presence in nature as different from nature? It's a very good question.
Yeah, but there's another emphasis to her question, which is that now, with the advent of a new consciousness, which is a big leap in conceptualization, but maybe that in the future, it's not the higher mind type of force. It, maybe it's not that consciousness so much.
But if you can see it,
yes, but what you mean, she means exactly yes to your question.
It would be nice if she thought she meant that.
You think she means that? She expresses herself some difference, but she means this. She means that exactly there is another force emerging, which is not mental, mind force. Which keeps things apart.
Well, when I watch the American political situation, I don't see anything different at all.
I'm quite sensitive to
I ask myself, why, and from where comes the force to describe nature? And finding a theory, like theory of evolution. What gives us, where is this force coming from?
simply because we don't find more than a theory. And this theory, what tells us about nature? And if I go further, I ask, how can this give the answer to my question, who am I?
Yeah, this has been the focus of the last 8 weeks of presentations, and especially the last two. I'll give you the last one, which is the best statement that we arrived at so far. But the whole scope of the development of the theory shows a couple of things. It shows, for one thing, that the analytical deductive mind observes so many instances of change just observing nature and the fossil record and embryology, and more observing in deep time when things have occurred and what occurred, and just putting the blocks in place, the mind spontaneously notices that there is a temporal continuity over a very long period of time, with change always related, always new, but always related to the past. So it's impossible not to arrive at a theory of continuity of change, otherwise known as evolution. So that, there's no mystery about where that comes from. It's just a matter of observation. The attempt to utilize that, to draw from that something that gives meaning to human being and to civilization and so on, is really interesting, I think. The fact that we, after noticing this process and not being able to explain it adequately, we have a theory of it, but not knowing really what it is, and this was the big question that we asked last time, what is it that is evolving? Because everything changes all the time, and nothing is left from centuries past or millennia past, and yet it goes on. So life goes on. And so last time we focused on Bergson, because Bergson grasped all of the things that have been grasped in a very original, immediate way. So his ideas became developed by many different streams of thought, but he grasped the main questions, and he criticized the main way of knowing, and he postulated how knowing has to evolve if we're going to really be fulfilled and understand and contribute to the process. There has to be a change, the direction of that change was intuitive. He had a strong intuition of the direction of that change, and it agrees perfectly with Sri Aurobindo's intuition that this rational mind, which has come up with this theory, has to abdicate, and there has to emerge a consciousness that is one with nature itself, that knows directly, and that perhaps is the whole purpose of the whole thing. from the beginning. So that consciousness, that supra intellectual, higher intuitive consciousness, he said, he suggests, is being. Being is that. And the whole process of time is for being to become what it is in life. So then, but with that ignition, you know, there's something happened then in 1907. It's very clear. Nothing could be clearer. That there was a spark of realization of the meaning of evolution.
Then he has to step out.
Yeah.
Of this ceiling.
So then it seems that Sri Aurobindo's whole philosophy of stepping out and allowing something else to come in comes from that spark also. And there are many other fields of development which come from that spark.
Einstein.
Yeah. And the theories were the product of a consciousness also. I mean, the theories were new, and they were based upon another conception of time. There was a shift in the conception of time and space. And so this is what this Bergson also perceived as a necessity. Of a shift in the perception of time. Because time is not what we think it is. It's not divided up into moments. He said that this new way of knowing would have nothing to do with the moments of time. The moments of time would cease to exist. Because the moments of time are in us. They're not in time itself. And so then there's this big question which I would ask. Is it possible? And he himself put that in brackets too. Is this consciousness of being itself, of duration, of being in life, being in matter, and realizing that consciousness is not different from that. Consciousness is its creativity. That's what he said. And I was just reading in Schrodinger in 1940, was saying exactly that too. That there's a way of perceiving existence by identity, in which existence itself is creative, and that creativity is evolution, and it is consciousness, and it's there all the way along from the beginning. But to perceive it, for us to become conscious of it, implies that it's already a part of nature. It's already the reality of nature. Consciousness is already the reality of nature. And I believe that's what Sri Aurobindo says. But we, in our mental development, are perceiving that. But we are not, we don't feel fully part of that. We feel, as Don said, like we're outside making a slop of it. We're uncomfortable with our mental, as you're saying, with our mental theorizing about that, because we perceive that it's more than our mental is making of it. our mind is making something of it, which gives us a hint of what it is, but we're still somehow experiencing this mind thing as separate from the flow, the duration, the energy. And so that is a question that has been perplexing philosophy, especially for a few hundred years. What is this mind? How does it work? And how does it happen to be in this whole complex of matter and life and spirit? And what is its role? And how does it work? And then philosophy begins to do what Bergson did, and what Heidegger did, and what Sri Aurobindo did. It points out that this rational mind that we've come to understand so well is not telling us the truth. It's telling us ideas, and it is giving us frames which we abstract from processes, and then we have the frames, but that's something that we have that may or may not be the reality. And so then the big question that philosophy arrives at is, can we get beyond the limitations of mind, or are we just stuck with it and we make the best of it? And so then this last question that I put on the board...
You didn't finish it.
At the very bottom, Sandy, you can scroll down. What evidence do we find to support the ideas of the past evolution of mind and possibly a future evolution beyond mind? What evidence do we find that mind has evolved at all? And that it, if it has evolved at all, it might evolve further. Because when we ask the question, when I ask that question, what evidence do we find, what I'm thinking is, we are aware that civilization, human civilization, is mind-directed life. What makes the difference between the human society and the animal or the insect society? That would be my question. And we ended last time, ended last time mentioning the work of Gebzer, who shows that there are stages of the development of mind, historical stages. There's the archaic and the magical and the mythical and the rational, and with this temper, with this breaking through of the time barrier, there becomes possible an integral consciousness. So in that respect, his thought agrees very closely with Sri Aurobindo. So if we look back at what characterized mind in its beginnings, we can see, to some extent, what characterized mind in its beginnings and how it has evolved with respect to society. Because societies have evolved, for example, through laws and organization and religion and art. And so societies, human societies, really are mental societies. they're not insect societies and animal herd societies and vegetable societies, they are mental societies. So we can ask about what is that which is specially human, and how has it evolved? Has it evolved? Or is it the same as it was to start with?
At least we have a mind to think, to use language, to cooperate. So also the mind is stimulated by environment, nature. What I want to call environment, nature, so including our human beings, relationship with human beings, nature. So mind will evolve according to respond to nature, environment. So we use also technology that the animals and insects they don't use. For instance, the internet. So mind stimulated by environment, including humans, nature, environment with the relationship with the others.
Let me ask you then. What do you think is the first clear indication that mind is working in nature in a way that is not there in other animals?
I think they have also, which I don't know.
No, but I'm not asking you what do they have. I'm asking you what do you see to be the clearest, strongest evidence that something called mind in some species is working, organizing nature, influencing nature in a way that's different and which is mental.
I think so, I feel.
Tell me an example.
For instance, a global warming,
no? No, I mean the first one in history. What's the first sign of it?
We use an instrument, tools. This is evidence how do we use, how do we make tools. This is great, I think we need.
Why do you suppose that happens?
Without tools, without engines, how we conquer, I don't like to conquer the nature, but without tools, instruments, engines, we cannot conquer the world, nature.
I think this is goes in the right direction. We have to allow ourselves to include in our conception of ourselves what we've been doing for the past 50,000 years. What is it that human beings do that characterizes us in the whole picture of evolving life? What is essentially us, the human being?
I think this is a question I'm bothering about already. I'm asking myself, how can we be so clear that our mind is so much different from, let's say, some animals' minds? Because newer researchers found out that many animals have thought processes like we have it. We couldn't only realize that before. We had no instruments to record that. Now it's possible to say that, say, a cat also has thought processes. And I think there is a barrier of perception also in ourselves, in human beings, to find out what is really the difference between animal mind, plant mind, and so on. And also, even minerals have the possibility to record information, which is a mind activity. So, what gives us the sureness to be so different? That is my question.
Okay, can you put that question in? I would like to answer the question, because I think that we're asking two different questions here. So my question is, what evidence do we have that our mind is different? Your question is, what evidence do we have that mind is not working in other species?
That's two questions. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And I spent the last 2 weeks emphasizing the idea that mind is working in all of those other species, mm-hmm. and we can identify with it very closely and understand it also. So I'm taking a step beyond that question by asking, what is the what characterizes the human mind? Not what characterizes the animal mind or the plant mind.
How can you distinguish if you don't know the animal mind?
Okay. Well, I think we can. I think we can distinguish very clearly.
You think?
Yeah. No, I think I feel certain that we can distinguish very clearly. So that's why I'm asking the question, because I think that if everyone puts their mind on that question, we will also all begin to see very clearly how we can make that distinction. And we need to make it. I want us to make that distinction very clearly and not to have any question about it. So your question, you have a doubt that that can be done. But before we answer that, let's try...
I have a theoretical doubt, just to free us from this male mindset. This is also part of male mindset. How we discuss now?
Do you have a female mind?
I have a female mind, for sure. But I have an answer to that.
There is
absolutely no doubt that there is a, as you said, a plant mind, an animal mind, but it has not got up to the level of the human mind, which obviously is an indication of evolution. And human mind has sophisticated language, number one, which we can read and write. That is one thing that animals don't have. And the human mind is capable of abstract thought. The animal mind figures, is able to think when there is a physical stimulus and it thinks and it remembers and all of that, but it needs that. It's not thinking abstractly. It's the kind of language
we use. What would be an example of abstract thinking?
Philosophy.
I think there's something a lot more practical that we can, if we come down a little bit. When human societies started to regulate the flow of food and started to regulate behavior, so that the individual doesn't just procure its food and build its nest and take care of its young, but regulations are made which require everyone to control their own urges for the sake of accumulating and providing for the whole. So that there's no longer just a vital drive to fulfill the survival of the species need, but there begins to emerge something called law and order, principles of the organization of life that not only get communicated, but are identified with and shared and recognized and valued. So there emerges in the human species something called values that control behavior. Behavior becomes voluntarily controlled because of an understanding of values. And then there's all kinds of spin-offs from that. There become philosophies and mythologies and religions and various kinds of institutions that reinforce those values. But the thing which strikes me as being the most characteristically human function is that our societies have been organized from a very early time according to principles which require the individual to control her behavior for the sake of the larger collectivity.
I want to make a question. Why we have to create law and order? Law and order.
Why what?
Why we have to create this law and order? If we see,
no.
I mean, if we have other parts, we take animals, they need this, or they can live together without this. But we as human beings,
yeah, but
can we live together without one more?
No, of course not. And animals also become, you know, all the animals have become extinct up until now. 99.9% of all species no longer exist. And so, I mean, on the biological level, animals manage to continue the species through vital behavior, which is augmented, no doubt, by mind. I mean, there is, you know, there are animals have abilities to make judgments and avoid dangers and so on, but they don't. They're apparently not as concerned as we are about controlling for the sake of survival. And so we seem to want to have a kind of insured longevity. We want to ensure that our food producing and distributing process goes on from generation to generation without a break. We seem to want to ensure that our offspring learn, not only learn how to survive, but learn how to perform more and more specialized activities in efficient, refined, productive ways. So our society is really made of highly developed, systematic procedures for the purpose of allowing our species to continue to thrive. Whereas in the vital level, species manage to continue to survive just through their struggle, their procreation, and eating whatever is there in the niche. But when the niche is no longer there, then they either evolve or they become extinct. So it seems that the human being's instinct to survive has pushed into this stream of organizing for the sake of. So every civilization, even though they're very different in their arts and their crafts and their languages and their organizational structures and so on, they all seem to be characterized by the principle of control of behavior for the sake of organizing sustenance. And now, as a result of the successfulness of the human, all the niches, in the sense that all the niches are being appropriated for the species' survival, and the species now is not even willing to sacrifice members who are not productive. We save everybody. And we are also willing to control our procreation to a point, you know, the idea of birth control is pretty ubiquitous. And so we don't seem to mind appropriating the environment of all the other species for our sake. But in order to do that, we regulate our own productivity and we sacrifice for those who are not productive. So there's this ethical, the human mind is characterized, seems to be characterized by this ethical behavior, that we want to heal everyone who is sick and prevent them from dying if possible. We want to feed everyone.
No.
Yeah. No, we do want to do that. You want to do that. I want to do that. You know, there are aberrations that occur in societies, and it seems that we can tolerate a level of poverty, but that level of poverty disturbs us because we know that if we alleviate it and make it a little more vital and dynamic, everybody benefits from that.
We have needs, but it's not.
But we want. My point is that we want to do it.
The urge is within a critical mass of human beings, or all human beings, or some human beings.
It's about the mind.
It's about the mind. There's
one more.
What I was wondering is that between animals, plants, and humans, like with the mind, there comes the possibility of choice and of seeing things as good and bad. And I don't know if this can come under the idea of getting away from natural senses. But humans, generally animals and plants, they will only do things that are not harmful to them, that will bring them forward, that are good for them. But with human beings, somehow, with the idea of choice, we many times do things that are harmful for ourselves.
Suicide bombs.
So the ethical mind, I just want to reinforce this idea that you obviously have gotten understood well, this idea of good and bad, you know, and the ethical mind is somehow the essential differentiating factor. There are many indications of that. So I would propose that a proposition that we might pursue further is that, in fact, that the what distinguishes the human species from other species is the ethical mind. The idea that we can sacrifice deliberately some of our drives for the sake of achieving our success, and that we can impose upon a whole society the necessity of sacrificing some drives in order to achieve success in some other areas. The problem is that we're not always right about it, but we're right enough about it that our civilization has continued to evolve in comparison to other species. We have not been around that long, and within within 10,000 years we have managed to overpopulate the earth and suppress all other species and maximize our gains from the resources, all the resources that are available. And so we have outgrown nature. And we've also come to the point, a critical point, of asking ourselves, what do we need to change about our behavior now that we see that it's not viable? And we speak about global society, global welfare. We've somehow gone beyond nationalism. We've gone beyond tribalism. We're moving towards globalism because we see that our survival depends upon an adjustment of the whole to all of its parts. So the mind is what's doing that. It's making an ethical, it's functioning ethically now with respect to the whole, not just with respect to the tribe and the community and the city and the nation. So it's the big question, of course, is whether it can manage it, because it also never got rid of all those other drives. So those vital drives that the animal has are still there. And the physical, the needs of the physical genetic material to propagate itself is still there. And so there's a limit to what we're willing to sacrifice. But the idea of sacrifice has been there, it seems to me, since sort of essentially since the human species began its course. And so if we ask the question of consciousness, what is consciousness? Obviously, we ask that question because we perceive the necessity of an adjustment between ourself and nature and society that leads us to will some controls on our behavior and to direct our behavior towards certain ends from an abstract point of view. We don't just charge out there, we think about it and we think about why we're going to do it. And so nature is giving us, our organism is giving us feedback in terms of understanding, images, possibilities, right and wrong, judgment is ethical mind. So rationality seems to be a byproduct of that ethical mind. Inspiration and intuition seem to be that ethical mind reaching for a larger picture, for a more direct, effective power. Somewhere in us, this chronic ascending movement to know more, to do better, to make the sacrifices, whether it's of ourselves or of someone else or of something else, to make those sacrifices in a way that ensure not only the success of the individual, but the success of the group. And each member of the group is making the same judgments, and so they're able to agree at a certain point, that it's this. This is the way we have to go. So there's a group mind that is ethical. It's not just the individual mind that's ethical. It's the group mind. And so in every species, there's a group mind, obviously, working. The birds migrating and the, you know, the penguins cooperating, and the group mind is not just new with us, but the group mind behaving ethically seems to be our unique essential qualifying difference.
Maybe we have to reflect on equality, and maybe we have to change this what is quality? Quality. We are going up to now, and we are living in a certain view of what is quality of life. We really have to reflect this, and maybe we have to change it. We have to give consciousness a larger space than only a certain quality.
Right. So, if you shift, you know, what I was focusing on was sort of the survival thing, just a second, but if you think about beauty, the appreciation of beauty, the love of beauty and harmony in human societies, how that has manifested, how part of the human being's survival grasps this, the importance of a qualitative element. Excellence and beauty and harmony. And in it seems that religion has been one of the primary evidences, expressions of this qualitative aspect of the ethical mind, and it comes through people who are inspired, people who have a cosmic consciousness, people who truly impart to others a sense of benevolence, spiritual sense. You know, that might be the root of the ethical mind. But in the whole picture, it seems that if there are other aspects of it which dominate, like the organization and the accumulation and the mastery of technique, what was a tool before now becomes a satellite radar equipment that allows us to drop a bomb on Iraq sitting in Washington. This is a big tool. But
it's true that the group mind is ethical, and that is why I think we all care about hungry people. We don't want to see them hungry. We want to feed them. At the same time, the group mind also is apathetic with regard to political governance, and then in places like the US they elect somebody like George Bush for two terms, and they are the ones that are making the choice, the deciding where the money goes, and spending billions of dollars, a billion a day, in wars. And here is where the difference between the male mind and the female mind comes in, because if a woman was in power, she would never choose to spend $1 billion a day. Maggie Thatcher is an aberration, I think.
but maybe what you mean is not, maybe you don't mean a woman. Maybe you mean
the feminine mind. And the feminine mind would put food, education, and healthcare up at the top and spend these $1 billion a day on those things. But it's men, hawks, they're called, all into war.
I always say men are educated by women.
There are two
kinds of men are educated by women.
I see the world increasing in population.
She has a son who is very dominating also.
I see the world increasing in population into the billions and billions and billions, and therefore because I want humanity to survive, I believe what we need is a tremendous plague, some terrible wars, and I want to see 95% of humanity completely and totally annihilated so that humanity can continue, because as it is now, it cannot. I don't care about hunger, I don't care about this, and of course, this is
I think that's where it ought to be.
But you know, even Schrödinger, who is a physicist, believed that it might be necessary for human beings to sacrifice and suppress some of their attainments for the sake of another evolution, and not just for the human. I mean, it seems with Sri Aurobindo, and it seems to go all the way back to Bergson quite clearly, that there is this idea in the human that maybe it can sacrifice for something beyond itself. That is radical ethical behavior.
I was just thinking when we talk about this, the question wasn't it also, what is that vital in the evolution? Is there something more? When I listen to this, I feel like, is it not even, you could say, you see the time frame in the different cycles of society, that mind itself has many levels. And there's a different domination at a different time. The modern mind, you know, uses mind in that way, that it has many good ideas, but it doesn't practice them. And so maybe in other civilization it was different. So is it not also here itself? What is reason in the level of mind? What is a more psychic mind, maybe more a feminine or male? Or so mind has many degrees, you know. And maybe this is also an important aspect there. Can we just say this is generally the mind which does all these contradictory things?
Well, I was suggesting that ethical mind is somehow, and that's practice, you know, that's the will to practice.
Yes.
And you use that word, and that's really what it's praxis. But we can also explore this, and another question that can be explored is what are the different levels of mind? What characterizes the different levels of mind? And is it important for us to discriminate and not just to say consciousness as a blanket term, but qualify it, you know, vital consciousness and vital mind and vital intuition and physical consciousness and physical mind and physical intuition and so on to begin to discriminate a little bit more clearly now that this human event has arrived at the point where we might be able to consider the integral being to explore in more detail the different levels of consciousness and not just to be satisfied with the blanket term. It's consciousness that evolves. When we ask, what is it that evolves? and then we answer that question with the term consciousness, we might reflect on what is meant by that term. And that term itself may have multidimensionality. And then when we get to the bottom question, what is the evidence that mind evolves at all? We should perhaps think about how can consciousness evolve? Consciousness has undoubtedly evolved up to a point. But if we mean by consciousness what is evolving, then maybe it has a long way to go. If we mean by consciousness something that doesn't evolve, something that is supernatural, then what's the relationship between that and what evolves?
Another question? The increase of knowledge, which is now phenomenal in these past 100 years, and go on and on and on and on, what does that have to do with consciousness? Isn't that a major factor? The more we know, and we're learning so much more, it's incredible, you know. What does that have to do with our consciousness? Doesn't it, I feel maybe it has an awful lot to do with the evolution of consciousness.
Good question.
I think
that
the this is good information, it's useful for our knowledge.
Useful knowledge or not useful knowledge?
We use our consciousness.
Okay, I think we explored these questions nicely tonight. Thank you.
There are three lines from Savitri that popped up when Vladimir was talking today, and when you were talking, and now when he. So I'm going to just tell. Cease not from knowledge. Let thy toil be vast. No more in earthly limits pen thy force.
Okay.
First you are perfect. Cease not from knowledge.
Yeah, I can add it later.
Where?
We can add that line later. You don't need to write it right now.
Her lines? No.
Yeah.
It's
please.
Yeah.
Well, as far as the evidence, we have said more things than that. We said language, we said ethics, we said values. Well, ethics and abstract
Sandy,
thought.
Were you not grabbing those?
Well, you know, no, we were talking about these questions, and then we went down to the bottom, and then we went up. So, I'm trying to do it.
Thank you. We will continue elaborating these and add questions to them. And who else missed last week's talk? Did anyone else miss last week's talk besides those two? And you? Would you be willing? Would you two be willing to see last week's talk at home? Then you've come up to level. Yeah, we have it. I mean, there were several sessions leading up to last week's talk, and I think it's from last week we can move away from the frame. But we have to be clear about what the frame is. And so that, I believe, was stated quite thoroughly last week. The frame beyond which we have to move, and why we have to move beyond it, and what are its limitations. That has been the subject of 20th century philosophy.
find it amazing that every time you introduce an idea, then we get this, and the same idea recurs. When you were talking about the Pashyanti and the Mahapashyanti, and he talks about the early 20th century, and the dawn, the click, the idea comes, Ali Bergson picks it up, and then it's opened up, and there it is.
I thought that too.
Same thing. Yes, same thing. Same thing.